Capitan America che dà la palla, si chiude il triangolo fra lui e Giroud, ed è Christian Pulisic che segna un meraviglioso 2-0 USA.
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Sempre Milan podcast. I'm your host Ollie Fisher, joined once again by Anthony Torgrud.
What's up guys, glad to be back. And we got Madison as well. We're a jerseyed out crew today.
Yeah, I decided to wear some Milan stuff for once. So.
Yeah, I'll be honest, the only reason I have it on is because I was shirtless on the couch watching TikTok and then saw the time and said, oh, I got to get in there. And luckily I have a wall of jerseys, so I just grabbed a shirt.
Comment below if you want AJ to do the next one shirtless.
Please don't.
Before we dive into this week's episode, as always, we've got to say thank you to our founding members on Substack, Ali Tarin, Tito, Matt Moritz, Paulman, Joey Gawler, Kemin, and MJ. If you haven't already, I know we say it every week, but go and check out what we're doing on Substack. We've been working really hard on that during the summer transfer window, which has now come to an end, but there's some good reflection pieces going out. And of course, the bonus podcast, which the most recent one was our reaction to the Champions League draw, not long after it had been done. So for that reason, we're only sort of going to mention it here and there on this podcast. Of course, we can't avoid it. But if you want to see that and also a bit of an analysis of the opponents and the 11s that we'll face and stuff, then that's on the bonus podcast. And if you don't know if you want to try it, you can do it 7 days for free. And then it's $5 a month or 50 for the year. So, yeah, thank you to everyone who's been supporting what we do over there. Now let's dive in, boys. I would say, with respect to the other two opponents that we faced this season, the game against Roma on Friday night was our first real big test.
Mm-hmm. Were the lowest in the table.
Yeah, I was just going to say, they hadn't started the season well. 1 point out of six available, including a defeat against Hellas Verona in their most recent game. The pressure was on Mourinho, who was back on the sidelines after serving a ban. And ultimately, I expected us to face a really fired up Roma team who had something to prove. Now, their preparation for the game was basically marred by the uncertainty of whether Dybala was going to be available at all, whether Lukaku was going to be signed in time. In the end, he was, and he came off the bench. Whether Pellegrini was going to be fit. There was doubts about who was going to be playing in the midfield and at wing back. So they were a bit all over the place coming into this, whereas we were able to name a starting lineup that was the same for the third game in a row, and I think that really helped us. Let's start from pretty much the first meaningful attack that we managed to formulate. It was a nice little give and go. Ruben Loftus-Cheek goes through on goal, the defender manages to get across and block his effort, and then as he's sort of barreling through to maybe get to the loose ball, he's taken out by Rui Patricio. Now, when this happened in real time, don't know about you boys, but I didn't think anything of it. I just thought, he's been crowded out there.
I thought the penalty came after he shot. He was pushed to the ground. I didn't see the actual kick to the ankle.
Yeah,
I think it really bailed him out, to be honest with you, because he could have squared it, and I don't remember who was there. But I think it was either Reinders or Pulisic. Someone was open in the middle of the box, and I was like, oh, you should have passed that. I think it honestly bailed him out. It was a fantastic run. The give and go was great, and he obviously got the job done in the end because of the penalty. But yeah, when he went down, I was like, squandered chance. But you know, it's only 8-7 minutes in, whatever it is. And then they showed the replay, and I immediately was like, I felt like the that gif of DiCaprio from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, where he's like,
yeah.
I was like, oh shit, that's a penalty.
Yeah.
And then obviously it was. So yeah, Giroud, 4 goals of the season.
I know. Can we talk about how he already has 4 goals?
It's crazy. I mean, 3 of them are penalties, so let's be real with that, which is
honestly
even crazier. You know?
Yeah.
I think we had 3 penalties all season last year, so to have 3 in the first 3 games, I'll take it.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll take the Pilan chance. It doesn't bother me.
Yeah, Pilan's fine with me. I think only one of them as well has been debatable. The handball one, I think we all admitted, you know, by the letter of the law, it probably is, but it's not the kind of penalty that you'd want to win a game by. Mm-hmm. Thankfully, we went on and scored enough goals to win comfortably anyway. But that was the only one where I think rival fans might look at it and say, yeah, they got fortunate there. This one was kind of mad. Like, I still feel a bit for Patricio because he's coming out to make a genuine play for the ball. But the problem is the way that he went in and his leg bounce sort of being in an upwards trajectory, it just... It, when you do that freeze frame and his studs are making contact with Loftus-Cheek's shin, basically, it was going to be given. It was always going to be given, you know? And I want to know how he ended up in that position, to be honest. But
I think it's natural to, you know, roll your body and fling your legs over when you're making that movement, right? Like, that's what you expect him to do. And you can't, in that split second, expect him to remember, keep your legs down, you know? Only rotate at the waist or whatever, but ultimately that's what you have to do in that situation. And goalkeepers know that they are trained for situations just like this, because it is a penalty that gets called, and we know it gets called. So at the end of the day, it is a penalty, and it's harsh on him. But also, this is a guy who has cost Roma points early on in every game this season. So at some point, you just got to throw your hands up and say, like, this is Rui Patricio. You know, like, we got to do better.
I was I was in Maine the past week, for the listeners who don't know, and I stayed with my cousin, whose husband is a Roma fan. They actually both live in Rome. And I go, how's your goalie? And then he messaged me yesterday, and he goes, you were asking about our goalie. And I was like, yeah, okay. You know? So
just goes to show, though, doesn't it? Because there are some Serie A teams that have invested in goalkeepers, you know, and looking around Europe as well, Onana going for over 50 mil to Man United. And you think that in doing so, you're getting a guaranteed number one for the future, but then sometimes it just doesn't work out. Like, sometimes they can be terrible moves. And we kind of got an absolute bargain with Maignan at 30 mil by comparison. I was the same as you, AJ. Like, when I was watching the game at Milan Club London with Steph, and we both kind of thought, well, that's it, chance over, chance squandered. And then when the replay came on, I slapped him on the shoulder and said, look at that, that's a penalty. And got given, and he took it really well. Again, you know, all of his penalty finishes have been absolutely emphatic.
He's on 8 for 8 now.
Yeah, that's good.
It's your consistency.
Is that in the league?
I don't know. I just remember last week someone said 7 for 7, so I'm just adding one.
it'll be league, because he missed the one in the Champions League against Napoli. So it must be his league penalty record. League. But I think he's only missed one for us. I'm sure someone will correct if not. That was 1-0. And I think that kind of conditioned the game a little bit, because all of a sudden Mourinho, who, by the way, after the penalty was given, was spotted on the sidelines clapping the officials, as he does. He'll get another ban for that probably. But ruined
Pioli shushing him.
Great man. That ruined his plan, I think, a little bit, because we know what Roma are like. They try and sit in. They were going to try and frustrate us, as they do every sort of top team that they play, and then try and hit us on the counter, especially with players missing like they had. And they weren't able to do that because of our early goal. So settled into the game quite nicely. We had a couple of good chances in the first half to double the advantage. I think the main one being that cross from deep on the left side, where Pulisic steals in at the far post, and that deserved the goal, because the technique to put that goalwards at all is, you know, he saw
that was an incredible save, to be honest with you.
It was, yeah. He cost them, but then he saved them from being 2-0 down at half time. But it was pretty much one way traffic, or certainly we were controlling the game. I didn't feel like we were at risk. There were just a couple of moments that would, I guess, set the tone for what was to come later in the game. The first came just before the 20th minute, when Tomori got his first yellow card. So it was the first one of the game in general. The referee, I knew it was. I think it was Rapuano, maybe?
It was Rapuano.
Yeah. He got both of his yellow cards, and obviously we'll come to the sending off, in the same way, and that was sort of going through the back of Belotti when he was trying to receive a ball. Now, I thought that this first one was a soft yellow card. It was quite harsh. As his first offence in the game.
Yeah.
It was early on too, right?
Yeah, it was the 19th.
Yeah, 19th.
This is my issue with it, because looking at the incident in a vacuum, they're both yellow cards to me. But then you have to weigh in the fact, very first foul of the game, or for him, weighing the fact that you've let every other foul from Roma slide at this point, and there was a lot of them. The second one there, you know, he got no other warning. It was just boom, boom. It was a soft for a second yellow. And I'll be honest, I don't know if there's anything in the rules that says, like, to take all that stuff into account. So taking that out, I just look at him and go, yeah, those are both yellows. As soon as he committed the second foul, I was like, well, he's gone. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah, yeah.
I think we all kind of agreed that that was going to happen.
And that was naive given how the first one had happened. AJ, you even said,
like, sub him at halftime, he's going to get a red card.
Yeah,
in the chat, we were like, he's going to get a red. The way he was playing with Belotti, anytime the ball got near Belotti, he was throwing him straight to the ground, which was honestly begging for them to bring on Lukaku anyways, which wasn't going to go well. And obviously he didn't get a goal, but he gave us trouble. He gave us a lot of trouble when he was on there. And then he created a silly foul and got his own yellow, which was funny, but we'll get to that in a bit.
Yeah, and then it was like the one where Rafa was galloping away as he does, and Celik nearly took his shorts off.
Yeah.
Like he had two separate grabs at him. Yeah.
And so it's Jonies.
No yellow card. And that's the consistency thing for me. It's like, okay, you're going to give Tomori those two yellows, and we might look at it and say, yeah, those are both yellow card incidents. But then when you're reffing the game to that standard, it's got to work both ways. And unfortunately, it didn't. And that's why, for me, Mourinho, by like not going to the post-match press conference because he thinks there's been another massive refereeing injustice, I think we've got a right to feel a little bit aggrieved as well, because now we've lost arguably our best centre-back for the derby. So that's it. That's where we are. But the sending off came after we'd managed to double our advantage, which was good news, because if we'd have had 10 men and one goal lead, I wouldn't have felt as confident. This was a glorious goal. Leao's first of the season, and it couldn't have come in a better way. Amazing cross from Calabria on the right wing, it must be said. Picked him out in isolation. Rafa got there just ahead of his man, and he's almost been lowered to the floor in the process. And
he's in a full squat. I mean, his ass is like a centimeter above the ground.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then manages to get his leg out from sort of the side. And I mean, people are calling it a bicycle kick. I suppose you could stretch to that because of the
motion. It's a side bicycle kind of.
It was like an acrobatic volley.
Yeah. I like blinked. And then all of a sudden I hear the announcers going like crazy. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, was that goal crazy or something? And then they showed the replay. And I was like, how the fuck did I miss that? It happened out of nowhere.
That shit was insane. Like, the way I reacted made it sound like I just watched a family member die. Like, I was like, oh my God. My dog jumped up. He's like, what's going on? What's going on? You know, I was dumbfounded. I just want to say that whole play was created by Pulisic. He didn't have the pre-assist, but he had like the pre on it. But still, he
Pulisic
that one
still had a good game. He hit the post
once,
and he just, you know, he frees up Leao so much. And then we'll go
on
to that.
You know what? He could have had two more goals. Teo didn't center it to him when he was wide open, and neither did Leao one time. In Leao's defense, there was another time where he did cut back to where Pulisic should have been, but Pulisic was on the byline instead, which I guess, you know, communication, they're new to each other, and Chelsea was a lot more straight in front of goal, whereas we've always been cut back. So, you know. You give and you take, but he had another good game.
Leao nearly set up Reinders again as well. One time he's going to nail one of those shots, but he needs to take a touch because he's going at it first time every time, and he's either slashing it wide or it's getting blocked because they know what's coming.
If he's taking these shots because he's afraid Pioli's going to turn him into a defensive mid and he wants to be an attacker.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, he's already shifted him to play six at one point this season, so I know what's coming next. That was 2-0, incredible goal, and at that point I felt result was safe and only a massive fuck-up on our part, like the home game last season when we were 2-0 up and just completely switched off for a set piece.
PTSD.
Yeah, honestly, I didn't feel comfortable at two. I needed a third.
Yeah.
And then when we got the red card and they got there first, I was like, oh, it's happening.
Thankfully, that didn't come until like the 93rd minute. And although they were on top when we went down to 10 men, but as they should be because they're two goals down and a man up. But they never created loads. I wouldn't say Maignan was incredibly busy. And then the goal that they did score came via a very, very lucky deflection. You know, if that shot carries on its course, Maignan gathers it comfortably. He was diving down near post. It takes one of those deflections that it's neither too big a deflection for it to take the sting out of the effort, nor is it minute enough where Maignan can still get to it. It just evaded his reach, and that's the only way they could score a goal, you know? It's unlucky more than anything. You'd say, can you just close him down a bit quicker? But
The game ended with us having 57 percent of the possession them on 43, obviously. Going into halftime, we had 71.
I was gonna say, yeah.
I mean, that just shows you how big of a difference a red card makes, and B, when they're pushing and we're saying, okay, let's just sit back and hold our double lead here, you know. So it definitely makes a big difference, but they had more shots than us. I'm looking at the numbers right now. They had more shots than us. They just weren't very good shots.
Mm. And that's would it have been different if Dybala was there or if Lukaku was fully fit, maybe.
Right. But that's the difference between us this season and last season. Is last season we were 25, 26 shots every game, but they were, you know, two on target. Mm-hmm. This time we're putting in six shots on target a game, and guess what? Two of them go in right away. Boom. Yeah. You know, it's like we actually have attackers. It's
seven goals in three games. Look at us. Who would have thought? Eight. Not me.
Isn't it? Isn't it eight?
Four, two, and
eight.
Two. Yeah, eight. Shit, now I can't math anymore. Yeah, eight goals in three games and two conceded as well. It's
amazing.
It's positive. I dare say it probably would have been a clean sheet, but for the red card too.
Yeah.
So you know, I'm really pleased with that, and I think we've looked progressively better each game too. This was a weird one because of what the early goal meant, and Roma and Mourinho's plan was just not ready for us taking an early lead. Like they needed to hang in as long as possible for the impact from the subs.
Well, that's always been their plan.
On earlier than they planned.
That's Mourinho's plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's forever. Frustrate and hold back. They want to sit deep and defend a 0-0 until you're exhausted from trying and you're annoyed. And then 75th minute, they're going to put all the pressure on you that they can for the final 15. We saw it in both games last season, and that's why we ended up with two draws last season. And this year we said, no, we're not going to do this. We have people who could get forward, who could fuck you up, and that's what we're going to do. And so we did.
I feel really, really good about the way we controlled the game at 1-0 up as well. Like, we did not let off at all. We didn't try to protect that lead. We remained on the front foot, as you said, 70% possession at the break. Shows they were still willing to give us the ball and see what we could do with it. But we just look so good in possession. Like, we're not rushing things anymore. We're able to keep the ball and we don't feel the panic. Like, we have all these different things going on that have been highlighted by various accounts on Twitter and whatnot. But, you know, you've got two fullbacks inverting to add bodies to midfield. You've got Reinders and Loftus-Cheek appearing on the forward line at times. You've got, you know, Krunic moving across. You've got Liao dropping deeper. Pulisic playing in the central area. Like, all these different things are making it harder and harder for opponents to predict what we do. But it's not unorganized chaos. Like, there's method to it. And I think that the whole thing has come together so far. And obviously the biggest test is to come after the international break. But so far, I think we've looked more and more fluid each game and more in control. So big thumbs up from me.
I don't know how we played without a right wing before. Like, the difference between Macias and Salamakers and then Pulisic is like night and day.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
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 It's only been three games. So, like, Pulisic has time to just, like, completely disappear. But
we saw it in preseason as well, right?
Yeah. It's just, like, shocking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Obviously, the signing of Chukwueze was the one that got fans, I would say, more equally, hype. If not more excited than the Pulisic signing because of what he brings. And we were thinking, oh, let's, you know, pace and power down both sides. We could be deadly by doing that. And yet, what we're seeing at the moment is a front three, but also linking with the midfield that seems to complement each other well. Pulisic brings something that Liao doesn't have. Liao has something Pulisic doesn't have. So it's perfect double threat. They complement each other well. And I don't see any reason to change.
And the team trusts Pulisic. Yeah. And, I mean, the new, like, all the new signings aside, right? Like, you saw last season, like, they weren't really passing it to CDK much. I mean, right, so like he is doing horrible, but you can tell that the team is trusting the players that we brought in, which is great to see.
Yeah, and obviously some players still to bring into the fold as well. I feel like we haven't seen Musa unleashed yet. Like the substitutes that we've been bringing on off the bench, it's great that the game is basically already tied up when these players are coming on, but also it means that they're asked to do completely different things compared to if we were chasing a goal, you know? Pioli is not going to say, especially when we had 10 men, he's not going to say to Okafor and Chukwueze, right, you two bomb up the other end. That's not going to happen. They have to play the attritional game and we've got a lead to protect. And those are difficult circumstances to come on for as a forward. But yeah, it's a job well done. Really happy with that. And also, I love winning on a Friday and then letting all the chaos follow afterwards. You know,
I didn't even watch the games yesterday. It was so nice. You know, yeah. I got home in time for the last 15 minutes of Napoli's first defeat. That was fun. It was great. I didn't have to worry about, like, oh, is Napoli going to take the lead? I just got to watch them lose. It was
cool. Did that finish 3-1 or was it 2-1? I thought they had two offside goals.
Yeah, it was 2-1. Yeah.
2-1. Yeah. So we are currently alone at the top, but Inter play
today. Fiorentina.
This evening against Fiorentina at home, which will not be easy, but Fiorentina probably roll over for them. They're one of those teams. Inter always seem to find it easy in the games against teams where we say, oh, that's a banana skin. We'll see, though. That'll be a good test for them, and we'll get a look at them, obviously, before the derby, which comes after the break. Play three games, and now we have a two-week break. Great scheduling, but a nice break after the transfer window madness and whatnot, and obviously we will preview the derby in next week's episode. Tops and flops, then top.
Yeah, I'll let you go first.
This is a tough one, because there are a lot of players that, for me, did their jobs very well. So I don't think there's one player who absolutely stands out and was like, he's 100% the man of the match, you know. And I think a lot of players did their jobs to a 7 out of 10 level, and that's what you need. The quality will do the rest for us against a team like Roma. I really liked the job that Loftus-Cheek did. I know that, as you mentioned, he could have perhaps squared for that penalty incident and got an assist to his name. Kind of gets the assist by drawing the penalty. But if you just watch him closely, Reinders is the more flashy, the more... I think he's just better technical quality player. Don't get me wrong. But if you watch Loftus-Cheek and the ground that he covers and the battles that he gets involved in, he always seems to know the right moment to drop back and the right moment to push forward. He went on that run, which, you know, reinforces our theory that when he gets in stride, nobody can stop him. He does a very important job, and I think he's been an unsung hero out of our new signings that everybody's raving about. And also, I feel like you two are going to go with someone else, so I'm going to pick RLC.
Yeah, I was going to go actually with Rade Krunic. Oh. If you look at his stats for this game, the dude completed 70 passes. For comparison, Loftus-Cheek only took 18. The amount of work that Krunic is doing silently in the midfield is incredible. I think he's really coming into his own in the six role. I mean, there was a point where he was under pressure from like four different Roma people and just did a double pirouette and stood where he was. Didn't worry about it. Just perfectly fine. I'm really impressed with how he's doing. And, you know, Pioli the other day said, in his eye, Krunic is a starter. And I'm agreeing at this point. You know, I've been really impressed with him. And I think what he's done in the midfield, obviously he's not going forward in attack. He's playing a more defensive role, but he's just preventing situations that put us in trouble. And he's not trying to force the creation of an attack. He's just doing what he's supposed to do. He's doing the simple stuff, and he's doing it so well that, I don't know, I'm becoming a big fan here. I'm starting to see Isaac saw a couple years ago. Yeah.
I'm going with Leal. I feel like the past two games he's been kind of quiet, and this game he just kind of took off. So,
yeah, I'm glad one of you picked Leal, because it was an absolute mismatch on that right side. I knew that Celik would struggle with him, and Mancini being then exposed a lot as on the right side of that defense, it was tough. But there aren't many fullbacks in the world who can keep up with Leal, you know, speed wise and pure athleticism. So they'll face no better wingers in Serie A than that, dare I say. Flop. It's just going to have to be Tomori.
Yeah.
Took a naive second yellow card that put the result in jeopardy. So I think that's a pretty straightforward one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not going to try and be edgy and pick someone else. Yeah. We'll move on then. So the beauty of the transfer window is that it ends late in August when the season's already started. This year, it fell on the day that we had a game. which is just perfect for everybody involved. So while the team are traveling to Rome for this game, and Pioli's having to relay the results of the Champions League draw while they're on the plane, and no doubt getting updates on targets that we're going for while in transit to an actual game, that I don't like it. Pioli said in his press conference that there needs to be something worked out where the transfer window ends before the games start. I can see arguments both ways for that. Like, I think, you know, you can get more interesting narratives out of the overlap, but just an absolute farce that we're playing on the night of deadline day. For avoidance of any doubt, we are going to cover the Luka Jovic signing separately on the bonus podcast that's coming up next. So we won't talk too specifically about him. And instead, what we're going to do is give the summer transfer window overall a score based on how we think we did business-wise, incomings and outgoings. Obviously, we signed 10 players, literally too many to list, but I'm sure we'll mention them all as we go through this. Then obviously the outgoings as well, because people forget, it seems like so long ago now, that this summer started with the club record sale of Sandro Tonali. And from there, you know, everything followed. Do you want to dive in, AJ?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just say it gets an A for me. I think I was one of the few people that didn't get upset about the Tonali thing immediately. You know, right away I was like, you know, it sucks he's gone, but it makes sense. Like, it is what it is. I was, you know, Cubadere's video of like, oh, we got an extra 70 mil. Well, yeah, I was thrilled about that. And, you know, this is exactly why I had faith we'd reinvest it. I didn't think that we wouldn't. You know, it showed that the only reason we weren't investing last summer was because we didn't make anything. We didn't sell anyone. Instead, we let big players leave for free. And that obviously means you can't spend anything. So when we make a club record sell departure, we have a lot to play with. And we knew we had about 40, 50 mil, and then sales on top of that. And then all of a sudden we had, you know, over 100 million. And one thing that we're really good at, or, well, I guess this is the first window of this new ownership, but is getting players at, like, that are slightly out of form towards the end of their contract, maybe had a rough year, that whatever it's done to lower their value.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Buying in the dip. And we did that. We got Pulisic after arguably his worst season in his career. We got Loftus-Cheek coming off of injuries. We got Chukwueze, who actually had a good season, but is young and relatively an unknown property. So his value was about where it should have been, I think.
And deal expiring in 2024 as
yes,
well. Yes,
yeah, last year. And that just kept kind of being the story of the window. And we kept getting good players after good players, and somehow they all clicked. And then somehow we get this algorithm signing that everyone laughed at, that made fun of the algorithm. Well, here comes Tijani Reinder, someone no one had heard of. Let's be real. If you say you did, you're either local to the Dutch league or you're lying. And he came in and he's one of the best players we've ever seen, it looks like. I mean, this dude's been incredible. So I have no issues. We got rid of almost all of the dead weight. We still got Caldara on the books, which is hilarious. But we were able to get rid of Origi on the last day. We were able to get rid of Foto Balotelli on the last day. And as a result, we promoted a youth player in Bartezaghi. So that's exciting. We haven't done that in quite a few years. I mean, you could go on for days because there's so much activity from us. But yeah, I don't think we've made a single bad signing, which even if you go all the way back to Yong Hong Lee's summer when we spent, I believe we bought 10 players that summer as well or something like that. And there were a few where you're like, well, that was a weird one. Why would we get Fabio Barini? You know, why would we get Antonio Donnarumma as well? Like, there were a few weird signings there, but overall we're like, yeah, this is good. This is really well. And then it all flopped. This summer, it doesn't sound like there's anyone that wasn't worth it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give us a B plus, but it's like an 89%. It's not like, you know, I would have liked a starting level defensive signing. I feel like our defense is a little light. But other than that, like, we bolstered our attack, we bolstered our midfield surprisingly. I mean, I would say 24 to 48 hours after losing Tonali, I was like real salty about it. But then I was like, I mean, let's give it the summer. Let's see what Jerry does, right? Like, he can either pocket the money or he can reinvest it. And to my, like, I did not think he was going to, but he reinvested it all, and they did a brilliant job. I would have just liked to see a starting level defensive center back sign.
Yeah, it gets a B plus from me as well, for pretty much all the reasons that you guys have mentioned. I think there was a few takes at the time about Tonali's sale and how, in order for it to be justified, we not only had to reinvest the money and then some, but we had to pretty much hit on every signing. Otherwise, it was going to be a PR nightmare for the ownership to try and justify. And I think they did that. Like we, I think the market kind of went in three phases for us. The first phase was all of the chaos surrounding Maldini, Massara going, who's going to be leading stuff? It's going to be Ferlani and Moncada. Oh my God, their first big move is to sell, you know, someone who was going to be a future icon of the club. What the fuck are we doing here? And then it calmed down into like quite a long second phase where we began negotiating on various targets, but with a clear strategy of trying to buy players, as AJ said, in the dip or contracts expiring, or but in positions that we needed. So they rebuilt the midfield with the signings of Reinders and Loftus-Cheek, and then Musa came later on. They signed good quality players for the attack, Pulisic and Chukwueze for the right side. Okafor is a bit of a wild card. That was when the bulk of the business was done. And then we came to the end of the window where it became obvious in this third phase that we were looking to offload players, but also just add the icing on the cake by getting in a centre forward so Giroud doesn't have too much work to do. And I think there's just two or three things that have question marks for me. First is the striker thing. But when we go into the Jovic video, we can speak a bit more about it. But let's face it, Jovic wasn't the guy that we wanted going into the last few days of the window. I'm not gutted that it's happened now over someone like Rafa Mir, but that's not who we wanted. Not when someone with Taremi's scoring record was supposed to be coming in. And then I agree with Maddy. I would have liked a more experienced centre-back to come in. Not saying someone who's an out-and-out leader, captain of their current club or whatever, but just a safe pair of hands for when Chiao, Tomori, or Kalulu, whoever need a rest, because I think Kier's passed it physically. Pellegrino, I'm all for us investing in talent, but I don't think he'll be able to contribute right away. So that perhaps just leaves us a little bit thin. And then the other one is obviously the defensive midfield position. I am happy to say that Krunic is doing well so far. Obviously, there's the Benacer thing as well. Like, he'll be back hopefully for the second half of the season, and then things look a lot better. But we are a Krunic injury away from being an injury to any of the starting midfielders away from being a bit like, whoa, what's going on here? So maybe we could have got a deal done. It, you know, like Dominguez ended up going in the end in quite a low cost move to Nottingham Forest. So we could have got that done ultimately. But we chose to go down another path, and time will tell if we got it right. But B plus, like there was a lot going on. I think it's all come together nicely. It's so hard to have a perfect transfer window because, and keep saying about people who oversimplify how easy it is to get rid of dead wood. You know, the offers are going to come in for players like Maignan. Apparently, there was interest from Premier League teams like Kalulu. The players that actually have value, we're not going to be turning down loads of interest for Ante Rebic and for Divock Origi and for Fode Ballotore. So to just get them off the books is something. You know, we're not paying their wages for a year. So I think it's mostly ticks on the outgoing front as well. And yeah, there's just a couple of players short, maybe.
There's so much more that goes into it, though, than like just like making a good signing. Like, Pioli has to integrate the players properly, right? Like, when we signed the 11 under Young Hung Lee, was Montella still the coach or was that Gattuso?
Yeah, it was Montella.
Yeah, he just threw them in, right? Like, if he would have integrated them properly, like, things may have gone differently, right? So, I mean, I think, like, Pioli also gets some respect here. Also, like, Pulisic could have completely started the season dead. But, you know, he hit the ground running. Reinders is, like, prime Dutch midfielder, you know? And, like, there's just some Chelsea chemistry going on. It's like...
Yeah, I think there's a fair bit of luck that obviously goes into that. But to your point on integration, you know, it's another positive, you know, check for the management that they got a lot of these deals done very quickly. You know, right after Trinale was gone, I was like, okay, Pulisic, Loftus Cheek, Grinders, like we're doing these real quick. And then they got to play most of preseason together. And of course, you know, going for a lot of players from the same team, being from Chelsea, like, look, they had a horrible season last season. They might do even worse this season. Who knows? But if you buy from the same team, they're going to at least have some chemistry, unless you buy the two guys that don't like each other on the squad, which doesn't seem to be the case. And then knowing that we already had Tomori, we already had Giroud, like there is a core element there of people who have been through it all together, you know?
And they all those guys
won the Champions League together. Like they know how to play. So it definitely helps a lot. And that is a positive mark to Pioli for getting them to continue that style, and a positive mark to the management for recognizing that, look, we need a lot of players. We need a lot of players fast. And our opening 10 games is a nightmare. So we better do something right. So, yeah, I'm really thrilled with it all. One thing about the striker situation, you know, obviously Jovic was not the guy that we all wanted. I wanted Lukaku. I know a lot of people wanted Balogun. I wanted him as well early on. A lot of people wanted Taremi. Wasn't too fond of him myself, but that's okay. Look, Jovic isn't a bad player. You know, he's had a very average career at this point. Let's be real. He obviously had his crazy season at Eintracht that got him bought by Madrid, and then he didn't do too well there, but he was behind Benzema, who won the Ballon d'Or. Of course, he wasn't going to get a lot of minutes there. And then he was loaned back to Germany and did okay, nothing crazy. Last season, I think, was his highest. He had 6 goals last season for Fiorentina. And, you know, if you look at the numbers, he played like 31 league games. That's a bad return. But if you really dig deep into that, he only started 15 games, and the other games he was coming on the bench in like the 85th minute, the 90th minute, like late. It's you can't really count those ones towards it. The games that
he did start were in Europe as well, and so he ended with 13 goals overall. Because
I was just talking league games. That's all I was.
Yeah.
So I think he might come good. He's also 25 still. Remember, this is a guy who burst on the scene at 18 years old. Everyone thought he was going to be up there, one of the best. And then it didn't turn out that way, because making a move to the biggest club in the world at 18 years old behind a guy who's got holding a Ballon d'Or, you're not going to play a whole lot. You know, it is what it is. So I think he could come good. I think Giroud's 37. He's our clear starter. But if one thing goes wrong, if he's out, Jovic becomes the guy. And it's not like he doesn't have a supporting cast that could get the job done around him and help him out. Who knows? Maybe this is the environment he needs. Maybe he becomes our guy. He's got 7 years left in his career at minimum. So
yeah, I'm not disappointed about it. Taremi was a little old.
Yeah, he was 31.
Yeah. 31. But like, I'm sick of buying players in retirement age for sporting athletes. Mm-hmm. You know, like, let's get a player young who will hopefully develop into something.
Mm. Yeah.
It'd be nice to like buy a striker who's like scoring 20 goals a season, and you know, but we don't have that kind of money.
I think for what we were willing to invest, it was never. There's
something interesting that came out towards the end of the window as well, where we tried for Jonathan David from Lille, and like actually sent an offer, albeit it was a loan offer, which you can infer was a loan with obligation or something, you know, to try and defer the payment. But it sounds like he is still seen as the guy. So for years now, it feels like we've needed to go out and invest in a new starting centre forward for the future. Opinions of Jonathan David aside, for, you know, if those links become even more concrete, I think it shows that the management are aware that the signing towards the end of the summer window we've just had was always going to be someone to get us through the year. Now, there are people who rightly be pissed off with that, because it seems like that's been the case for a while now, and we haven't gone out and invested big on that centre forward. But
we signed 10 players this window.
Yeah, but like, also,
the money for a striker.
The striker, the striker, like, addition is like, it's a huge gamble, and it's a huge investment. So like, you want to make sure that you make the right move at the right time, right? Like, you don't want to overpay for Balogun, who could just flop. And to sign a player who's just going to hit the ground running is going to take massive investment.
Yeah, I mean, let's remember our club record fee is still Rui Costa at 42 million euros. Like,
that's 20 years ago.
If we want to sign a starting caliber striker who guarantees you those 20 goals a season, it will be a club record fee. We got to take that decision very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can't do it the same window that you just signed 10 other players, because, look, we had a shit ton of holes. We filled a lot of those holes. The boat's no longer sinking. Now, next summer, we might go all in for that striker and maybe a center back as well. But I wouldn't expect 10 players, not if we get another big striker.
No, and there would be no need to, because obviously the bulk of the overhaul was done this summer. And to the point that you mentioned earlier about how we got our business done, or the majority of it early and often, I think that implies two things to me. Number one, this management know what they're doing. You know, they do know how to go out there and close deals. There was a bit of apprehension about how experienced they are when it comes to negotiating directly over transfers. And the second is that I think we were prepared for the sale. I think we had in mind a few different plans. The first one, probably hang on to everybody that you can and just make targeted additions here and there. But one of the plans was definitely massive offer comes in for a star that you can't refuse. How would we spend that money? Because instantly the names came out and it's like, okay, then they're wanting these three midfielders. They're wanting two right wingers. Like, it's as if it was all mapped out from the start as part of the master plan. But yeah, so B plus for me, B plus for Maddie and AJ with a nice generous A.
Yeah, they're all roughly the same grade.
Yeah. We're not far apart at all there. And also, if Chuck and Okafor manage to get themselves in the goals, and it could change to like an A minus for me, to be honest. That we haven't seen everything from all of the new players yet. You know, Pellegrino could start in the cup or something and look really good. There's still question marks because we haven't seen enough of the players. But yeah, on paper, that's how we judge the business. Let's move on, shall we, to listener questions.
I'm going to ask the first question.
Oh, go on then. Yep.
All right. Oliver, you get to go to Champions League games. All right. What is your group that you let's see, how do I ask this? The perfect group based on stadiums that you have not been to.
One of them is we've got Dortmund, so I'm really happy with that. I was saying to everybody when they were asking who do we want, Dortmund. Never been to that stadium. Love Germany as a country, and hopefully I'll get to tick that one off, be it in the away end or if I can somehow get media for it. But yeah, that's a big tick. And obviously got to limit it to teams that we could have drawn in this edition, I suppose. I know they were the easy team in pot one, but I would have liked Feyenoord. I've never been to their stadium, and it would have been hopefully an easier game for us, but you never know, do you? I have been to Rotterdam, love the city, like proper old school port city. And yeah, they'd be one of them. And I can't even remember who was in pot four. I want to say Antwerp maybe would be cool. Oh no, Celtic. I know we've played Celtic in the Europa League a while ago. Was that during lockdown? I think it was. Yeah. And so it's not like a new opponent for us or anything, but obviously because it was lockdown, I didn't get to go to the away game, and I would like to do a game there.
We were getting media credits.
Yeah. Like the Shamrock Rovers one. I applied for media press access for Shamrock Rovers in the Europa League qualifiers, and they were like, not a chance.
Who the fuck is this guy?
Just not a chance. No, because there was it was at the time when you weren't allowed to travel unless it was for like very specific reasons. So there were no Italian journalists going over for it because they literally weren't permitted to travel. And I thought, well, there must be spots available. And they just, yeah, they were like, no, you're not coming over from England. You can stay away from Ireland, mate. The other teams in pot four, Galatasaray, I'd love to say that I'd do it, but that's, you know, that would have been crazy. That would have been madness. Newcastle's not bad, but I've been to St. James's Park a few times watching Huddersfield and even seen Shevchenko play there for Ukraine against England. So we got Newcastle, that is what it is. If you take Dortmund out and we could draw another German team, then definitely Union Berlin. That would have been cool. If you've ever been to Berlin, anybody will know it's a massive and incredible city. And the story of Union Berlin is remarkable. Their rise from the third, second division up to now playing Champions League while Hertha are in the second division. You know, that's crazy. So, yeah, I'll say them for, like, fan experience and doing something a bit different. But I can't really moan with the draw that we got, you know, in terms of destinations to go to.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Newcastle will be a good night out if we manage to get a result and go through. So, yeah, that's a good question. If you boys were to come over for any one Champions League away game, what would you want to do?
Probably something like the Bernabeu, Camp Nou, yeah. You know, the iconic ones. But although I will say, I saw the remodel for the Bernabeu. That shit is an eyesore. It looks horrible.
Looks awful.
It's just like, yeah, I mean,
it looks like a giant electrical box. Like,
this is a really, really, yeah. really obscure thing. Like, so before it actually looked like a football stadium, mm-hmm. and it looked like the biggest and best football stadium in the world. Like, it was so steep. There's five tiers. It's completely. Like a big bubble, basically. It was great, like such a good stadium. So glad I got to go before they completely changed it. Now, from the inside, with the roof that they've got, it looks like where the Indianapolis Colts play or something like that. You know, like an NFL yeah. stadium with a
yeah. It looks like they're trying to hide it.
Yeah, yeah, it's really weird, and I don't like it. And I don't actually really like what they're going to do with the Camp Nou either.
No,
to be honest. I
would like to go to, I think it's Porto Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
No. Maybe it's a Brazilian team. I don't know. There's one that, like, it's got, like, a crocodile or a dragon or something going around it that just looks cool. Maybe it's a Brazilian team.
Mine would be
probably
Dortmund and some Turkish team. Just because like the entire fan experience, right? Like,
yeah,
the flares, the smoke, the chants, the tifos, like that would just be unreal.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. The maddest thing is, I was looking at the Europa League draw, and obviously, I never want to go back there again if we can help it. But the Europa League has a lot of interesting teams in it. For example, Eintracht Frankfurt, who obviously won it like a couple of years ago. And I've been in the Champions League as a result, are in the same group as Aberdeen. So the idea of this fucking massive German club going to some small town in the north of Scotland, crazy.
I mean, that's like us going to Shamrock Rovers, yeah. right? Like, yeah. I remember watching that game, and there's just, like, apartments in the background. And I was like, imagine looking out your window and watching AC Milan play.
Right.
You know, it's just like... Wow. Well,
where was that one team we played? Dudelange.
Dudelange. Oh, yeah. And that team that was literally a university, Craiova or something. And Rio Ave was bad enough. You mm-hmm. know,
they almost beat us.
Man. Yeah, no, they should have done. Right, let's move on and do some questions.
Some this kind of feeds questions. Into it.
yeah. Although Maddie's was a good one. I like that one. Daniel Ahmed asks, have you got any tips for traveling to Milan for a match day? Maybe make a guide for fans if interested. Mm. Now, the guide thing, I quite like to potentially do as a bonus, you know, in full. But if I've got any tips for actually going to the city, obviously this is dependent on what kind of a game you're going for. If you're going for a massive fixture, it changes. But if you're just going for a game, a league game, I would recommend that, first of all, you stay in a place that's on a metro line so you can get to and from the stadium easily. You've got to factor in that night games kick off 8:45 or 9:00 in the evening. So that means that you're leaving the stadium at 11:00 and the metro shuts at midnight and there's massive crowds. So the thing that I always do is walk to Lotto station instead of going to the San Siro station, because that's chaos. It's like a cattle market there. Lotto station is just short of a mile, I think. It's like 15-20 minute walk, and it's much quieter there, and you can get on the red line straight to the city center. So I would recommend doing that. Show up a couple of hours before the game. First of all, it makes the travel easier for you. There's less of a hectic journey. But also, as AJ will testify, there is an awful lot going on outside the stadium as well. There's all food vendors, merchandise vendors. You can go and get, you know, cheap bottles of beer if you like a drink before the game. The fans arrive, you know, there's chanting, and you can see the ultras going in, and It's just generally a great place to be because San Siro is like this big spaceship dropped in the middle of an area with nothing going on. But then on a match day, it becomes quite a cool, vibrant place to be. So go and soak it all in.
Yeah, I would definitely echo stay somewhere near a metro line. Don't stay near San Siro, but just pick somewhere near a metro station because San Siro's kind of out of the way. And there's not a whole lot to do around there outside of the game day stuff. Staying towards like the Duomo is a lot more expensive, so you could get somewhere in the city. And then near the metro station, Duomo is probably like 10 minutes away at most from anywhere in there. So that's where you'll get all your fun stuff. I would say do Casa Milan not on a game day, or if you do it on a game day, go early in the morning. It gets pretty busy. Same with the museum. Get your tickets either ahead of time if you can on the website, or again in the morning of, because that will fill up very quickly and the lines get long and it gets hot out there depending on the time of year. Mm-hmm. If you're going towards San Siro, there are two metro stations for San Siro. There's just San Siro, which is right in front of the stadium, and then the one prior to that is San Siro Ippodromo. Go to that one, and then you get it's not a long walk, it's maybe a tenth of a mile to the San Siro station, but you get to walk with everyone towards this, you know, icon of football, something that if you've seen it, you know, if you haven't seen it, it'll change your life. So definitely make the walk, take it in and enjoy it. It's awesome. Once you get outside there, like always said, 2 hours early around there, you'll see all the ultras. They're all standing outside of the Giuseppe Meazza restaurant. Go in there, get in there early as well, because it gets packed. Get some pizza, pasta, whatever, you know, eat food. Stay out of the bathroom. Bathroom, there's a lot of use of substances that you'll see from a lot of the ultras, and they'll offer it to you. So if that's your vibe, you know, go in. If it's not, and stay out. But so do that, and then you walk into the stadium with all the ultras. Get inside for the warm-ups about, I don't know, 30-45 minutes before kickoff, and you'll hear a lot of the chants. You get to see all the crowd. You'll hear the Pillies on fire. There's a lot of cool stuff there. And then what Ollie said after game, walk the Lotto station. It's three away. It's about a mile walk. It's worth it because you will cut so much congestion out of your metro trip there. And
My tip is don't plan a trip with English people because they are very flaky.
I'm not going to comment on that. I'll just move on. I don't have all to say. If you like going to a bar or going for somewhere to sit down and eat before a game, there is a little spot opposite the road outside the stadium called Piazza Axum, and around there's a few cool bars, and they all show the football as well. So, like when I went last time for Roma Milan last January, they were showing the Napoli game before. It was packed with everybody rooting for Napoli to lose for us to then go and hopefully cut the gap on them. It didn't end up happening that way, obviously. But yeah, that's good, and there's some great food around there as well. And then yeah, the city is what it is. I wouldn't tell you anything other than what travel guides would say. But yeah, it is good, and there's quite a few things as well that are in and around the stadium that are cash only. So that's something to bear in mind, because obviously I feel like probably the same in the US as it is in the UK, like everything's contactless now. Yeah. And some places haven't yet caught up to that.
Oh, so. And the metro is contactless in Milan now as well. You could use your debit card, credit card, like you don't have to get a metro pass. So that's helpful.
Yeah. Enjoy your trip if you're going. I am going through these. Abderrahman asks, if Tonali was still at Milan, do you think he would be a starter in this team?
If Tonali was still at Milan, this team wouldn't be the team we have. He would be a starter. But obviously, hypothetical, slotting into this exact lineup, I think he'd start. But I don't know over who. I think that's a tough one. Probably Krunic, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that would suit Tonali the best. I don't know if it'd work out as well.
Same.
You could point that as well about the fact that this team wouldn't be as it is if it wasn't for Tonali going. It's a necessary sacrifice. We got a few questions.
Take one for the team.
Yeah. He'll be back one day as well. I noticed the hype's kind of died down a bit after Newcastle have lost three out of their first four games. And he was a bit of a passenger last night against Brighton, who beat them 3-0. I think Brighton showed the blueprint 3-1. Of how to beat... Oh, yeah, they did score a late consolation. Brighton showed the blueprint of how to beat Newcastle. I was Deshurbi massively out-coaching them. Yeah, that was encouraging for us. We got a few questions about Pioli and what we think of how he's done to start the season. Obviously, the players get plenty of attention. But Stu, for example, asks, are you guys satisfied with the playing style Pioli's going for? Is there anything that feels like a red flag in the long run? Casey asks, how do you see Pioli and how he's got the team going? And does it give you confidence for the next five games?
It does.
I don't like Pioli, but he is doing a phenomenal job with this team.
Yeah, that's kind of it. You know, I've always been very tentative. I always felt like he's not the guy to get us to the next level. Maybe he is. Maybe he just needed his players. You know, he kept getting Maldini's players, not his. This summer, he had a lot of say in the transfers, and it's working out. So he clearly had a plan. He clearly had a style he wanted to implement. The formation change for this season obviously worked out well. I mean, yes, we're three games in. We really haven't played anyone of top caliber because Roma's in the bottom three right now. So, it's a lot to be seen, and we'll find out a lot more in the Derby, especially without our starting center back in Tomori. But Pioli's the second Milan manager to ever break 300 Serie A points, Carlo Ancelotti being the first. I mean, that says something. It says longevity, I guess. But look, that says something. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm happy with him. I don't know if he's the guy, but look, I'm going to give him all the confidence until he takes it from me. You know, last season he did take it from me. This season he's got it back. So we'll see.
Yeah, I'm not going to walk it back and say that, you know, I've always backed him even during the difficult moments last season. There was one point last season, I think, when we had that second dip in March, and I thought, it's not like I want his head on a stick or anything. It was just that I thought the players had lost faith in what he was trying to convey. Even he didn't really know what he was trying to do anymore. To get sort of outplayed in those two Champions League games against Inter showed that he'd not learned from those mistakes again. Maldini was quite publicly frustrated with some of the results as well, and rightly so. I thought his story had reached the end credits with us, and yet here we are now, and I feel really glad that we've gone with consistency and continuity. Where a lot of teams in Serie A have had quite a bit of overhaul this summer, here we are. You know, we feel like, of course, we've got the signings to come in, but at least we've got him as the one constant who we know can produce good football, we know can win us games, took us far in Europe, has a Scudetto to his name. Now let's see what he can do juggling these new pieces, the ones that he asked for. So I feel pretty good about things at the moment. Now, the red flags thing, yes, there are still some, to be honest. I still think we look defensively quite shaky. Sometimes inattention and positioning and stuff like that, like you can't keep exposing Calabria 1v1. Krunic against a better midfield maybe comes under a bit more pressure. Tomori's still making mistakes. How long is it until the team figures out how to catch Teo when he's young? You know, there are things there that I think we need to iron out. But if we were absolutely perfect from game week one, I'd be quite worried, to be honest. Like, it is a work in progress. We've got to, you know, we've got to get these new signings gelling. And I think so far, 9 points out of nine, 8 goals scored, 2 goals conceded, top of the league, potentially tied, potentially outright. I don't know how we can complain. It was pretty good to me.
Yeah, and I think it just shows that, like, Maldini didn't trust him. That's why he was not giving Pioli the players that he wanted, because he probably didn't think that Pioli was going to be here. So.
We'll end with one question that I got sent via email. You can actually send questions for the podcast via email to info@sempremilan.com. It comes from Antonino Licandro. He says, do you think Milan can win our group of death, and which game worries you the most? Then he also says thoughts on Inter's new team playing against our team, which we'll cover in the preview next week. So, yeah, group of death.
Yes, I do think we could top it. Looking at how all the teams have played this season, you know, Newcastle have lost 3 in a row here, pretty massively this weekend as well. Dortmund were up 2-0 and end up drawing 2-2 this weekend against a newly promoted side.
Weren't they at home as well?
They were at home. PSG won 3-1 against Lens, but it was also their first win of the season. So they're not doing too hot all around. PSG still worries me because obviously Mbappe's Mbappe and he could do all kinds of stuff, you know, at any point. He's one of the best players on earth. Also Donnarumma, you don't want to lose a point to your former goalkeeper who has, you know, been excommunicated from the city, so to speak. You don't want that to happen. You also don't want to lose to Tonali's new team. You know, you want to show like, oh, you guys made the mistake, not us. And Dortmund, I mean, it is what it is. I don't have any negative feelings towards them one way or another. It doesn't move me. But yeah, I would still say PSG is the team you worry the most about.
I actually have a Dortmund jersey. But
I have a PSG jersey.
Actually, so he's not an Inter player, so maybe I should burn it. PSG away is a game that worries me the most. And yes, I do think that we can top the group.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with that. I think we can. I think any team, barring probably Dortmund, can realistically
think. I think barring Newcastle.
Yeah,
Dortmund at least have Champions League experience.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. But I think Newcastle have the quality and the depth to still cause problems. Also, you look at yesterday and yeah, they lost 3-0 to Brighton and 3-1, sorry, to Brighton. And I think that shows, you know, there are things to be exploited with them. But then also they beat Aston Villa 5-1 and they looked unstoppable there. So both teams, all teams probably have quite a high ceiling and quite a low floor. And it's whoever manages to minimise that the most. Mm-hmm. And why can't it be us? You know, I like that we've got Newcastle home first game. I hope that that's a real, real difficult atmosphere for them to deal with. It's probably the game that they were dreading the most, you know, in terms of subjecting a young squad to such.
And remember, PSG away is also played in between Juventus and Napoli. So, like, that's...
Just write that off, you know. Yeah, we're going to have to get points from the other games, maybe. But, yeah, who knows? That's another thing, like, PSG might have us still on quality in the starting 11, but we can go there and try and frustrate them and play to our strengths on the counter. So there's different matchups in every game that I think is going to make it the most interesting group, genuinely. And if we're good enough to go through, we will. It's that simple. And if we're not, then we've learned something. We'll wrap it up there. Thank you, as always, to our Substack founding members, as read out at the start of the episode, and to everyone who's supporting what we do there. Thank you to everyone who keeps interacting and engaging. I hope you're enjoying the start to the season. Let us know how you'd line up in the derby without Tomori. And let us know if you've seen any red flags from the team so far this season. I've been your host, Ollie Fisher. Find me on Twitter at Ollie Fisher. AJ, cheers for joining.
Yep, Tour 45.
And I don't know why my old Twitter handle's on here, but and it says Sempre Milan TV.
Just extra plug. Cheers. Yeah, thank you for watching, everyone. We'll catch you in a week's time.
Gol! Ancora Teo! È una meraviglia! Il gol di Teo Hernandez! Da un'area all'altra! È una meraviglia! Senti il mio...